fire.
Can you see it?
Big fire. You bet I can see it. Some house just exploded and ignited on fire.
It's the kind of story that sends a shiver down your spine.
Wait, were there people inside the house?
Yes, there are. They're probably dead.
A Scottsdale home rigged to explode.
There was a tremendous explosion. It just shook the whole house.
A young family dead inside.
I don't know what has happened, but I just asked for your prayers.
The Scottsdale Police Department has ruled this as a triple homicide.
Mom, Mary Fisher, 12-year-old Brittany, and 10-year-old Bobby, all killed before the explosion.
The only person we are looking for to help fill the puzzle here is Mr. Fisher.
The search for answers heats up.
They are literally going through every piece of ash in this house.
All clues pointing to one person.
We now consider him to be a suspect in the murders.
Their husband and father.
Robert Fisher.
Robert Fisher.
Robert Fisher.
A name that haunts investigators to this day.
This is by far the most grisly case I've ever seen.
The father turned fugitive, topping the FBI's most wanted list for nearly two decades. His last known steps.
The search itself started here.
Arizona's high country.
Do you think he's still out here?
I do.
There's always a chance that he's literally standing here watching us.
A search that's never really stopped.
And we get tips every week.
The hunt for Robert Fisher, dead or alive.
Just come home, please, Robert.
Will we ever know for sure?
Out of character and unexplainable. It's still beyond comprehension as far as how this could happen.
Hello.
I am Lauren.
And of course, I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Duck, duck, duck.
Paradise After Dark is an independent podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
and some urban legends.
Please check out our website, paradiseafterdark.com. On the website, you'll find links to all of our episodes, even the archived ones, our mailing list, merch store, links to our social medias, and of course, our Patreon.
And on our website, we also have a little virtual tip jar. So if you just want to help out the show, swing on by there, drop some coins in the little tip jar, and we'll give you a shout out on the show.
Speaking of shout outs, we have some shout outs for this week, the tip jar. First, we got Amy Bug from Miami.
Thank you, Amy.
She's just been like a super supporter of
amazing.
Our show.
We really,
we
appreciate,
really
that.
Appreciate you, Amy.
Also, from the other side of the country, James from San Jose, California.
San Jose, California. San Jose. I didn't know that our little podcast got all the way out to California.
Well, you know what? When we were out in CrimeCon, there were so many people from California, and I can only assume that this is one of those people that I met at CrimeCon.
And I've got Brad from Cape Coral. That's our neck of the woods.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it. Local.
Anything else?
Flo-Gro. No, I think that's going to be it. Although, Lauren, there is some kind of news we want to kind of bring up.
Yes. Actually, we want to tell you, our beautiful listeners, that this is going to be our last episode until August 1st.
People just got scared. Like, what do you mean last episode? What?
No, you guys are done? No, we're not done. We're not done. No, but this summer, I'm going to be doing some extensive traveling and we're going to be having family in town and we're just not going to be able to give all we can to the show.
Yeah, it's important that we try to bring you guys the best content possible with the best research. And right now it's just tough for us if we try to put it together because we're not going to give you all that factual content that we normally bring to the table.
So we decided it was in our best interest to take some time off and then get back to it when we can actually really get back to it.
So we're looking at, it's July 4th today.
Yes.
So that's the launch day that we're going to put this one out there. And then we're going to come back August 1st.
August 1st.
Will be the next release.
Yes.
Great. That's fantastic. Patrons, you guys will still get a little something here and there, a little dash of this, a little dash of that.
Yeah, we'll still do our off-topic uncuts and stuff on Patreon. We may even put some extra stuff on Patreon for them.
I think we got a few things coming up that we're going to throw on there for you. So if you're missing us and you really want to hear more content, there's plenty of it on Patreon. Hit up our website. You can click the link and it'll take you right there. So with that all being said, I think that's all for the news that we have, Lauren. And I kind of want to just kind of preface tonight's episode. The thing I hate about this particular case, and we've seen it in other cases, one, the most recent being Chris Watts, is when you're a child, you know, you're living in a home, the one guy that's supposed to protect you from the boogeyman turns out being the boogeyman.
Yeah.
That literally breaks my heart.
Yeah.
So with that being said, Lauren, you want to kind of get us started on tonight's case?
All right. Well, this week we are talking about a fugitive, Robert Fisher. On April 10th of 2001, shortly before 9 a.m., a quiet neighborhood in Scottsdale, Arizona was rocked by a huge explosion. It was the house at the end of a nice little cul-de-sac. They say the explosion was so large it collapsed the front brick wall of the home and rattled homes and windows up to a half mile away. The blast appeared to be centered in the living room, and the subsequent fire burned the house into rubble. The home belonged to the Fisher family. Robert, who was 40 at the time, his wife Mary, 38, and their two children, Brittany, who was 12, and Robert, aka Bobby Jr., who was 10. When rescuers were finally able to get inside the house, they discovered a shocking triple murder, the remains of Mary and the two children still in their beds. They appeared to have died before the explosion took place. Autopsies revealed that both children had their throats cut, and Mary, their mother, had her throat cut also, but she was also shot in the head. A natural gas line in the house had been severed. Someone poured a flammable liquid throughout the home to make the fire spread faster, lit a candle, and left the house. The only member not found in the house was Robert Fisher. Also, none of Robert's clothes were found in the home.
Not suspicious at all.
Why would he take all of his clothes?
Exactly.
Unless he committed this horrific crime and planned to run. So, Ken, can you tell us a little bit more about Robert Fisher and who he was?
Yeah, Robert William Fisher was born April 13th, 1961 in Brooklyn, New York, to William Fisher, a banker, and his mother, who was Jan Howe. Now, his parents divorced in 1976 when Robert was just 15 years old, and after this, he and his sisters went to live with their father all the way out in Arizona. Now, his parents' divorce is said to have hurt Robert deeply, and later on in life, he would tell many people that divorce was never an option in his marriage, and he would never put his children through what he felt as a kid. Now, Fisher had even refused to take his own children to Disneyland because this was the site of his parents' last screaming fight. Now, later on as an adult, he once confided in a coworker, not long before his family was murdered, that his life would have been very different if his mother had not left the family. So it appears as if the mother may have abandoned the family. I don't know the full details on that. I can't bring
that information. I couldn't find much any more details about his parents' marriage.
Yeah,
that's not really public record.
Yeah, I couldn't find it either. But apparently it played a devastating part in his life. I mean, Fisher's going to go on later to enlist in the United States Navy and even attempted to become part of the SEALs, but was not successful. Which, Lauren, what's the success rate of someone who goes into Navy SEALs?
I think it's like less than 10%.
Exactly. So this is not something that's easy to do whatsoever. And there's no participation trophy for that job. Well, he was an avid outdoorsman. He was a hunter and even a fisherman. And Fisher worked as a firefighter in California, but was forced to retire after he had a back injury. This back injury would plague him for the rest of his life. He attempted surgery to fix this problem, but still had a lot of pain. And he does have surgical scars on his lower back. He then moved his family out to Arizona and embarked on a career in the medical field. He worked as a surgical catheter technician, a respiratory therapist, and a surgical technician at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale at the time of his family's murder.
So Robert married Mary Cooper in 1987. He was described by his family and those who knew him as a man who could be cruel and distant. Some claimed he was a major control freak. Fisher would not allow the walls in the house to be painted anything other than white, and only a small number of pictures were allowed on the wall. Several times, her mother had made special things like quilts, Mary's friend Kimberly Sue Davidson told police. She was not allowed to hang them up. She had to store them in the closet. And then he would continually tell her, isn't it time you got rid of that stuff?
Sounds to me like it's the makings of, what was that movie we watched the other day that's old? Sleeping with the Enemy.
Ah, yes.
Very, very similar to that.
So friends told stories about Fisher's odd behavior, like when he killed an elk and then smeared its blood all over his own body, or the time during a fishing trip when he was seen swimming across the lake holding a Bowie knife in his teeth. Outwardly, he and Mary had a great marriage, but as often is the case, in reality, they fought a lot about sex and money. He once turned a garden hose on Mary after he perceived her to have spoken out of turn. At one point, Mary even started stashing money, calling it her security fund, so she could leave Robert if she needed to. He didn't appear to be very nice to his children either. He was embarrassed that his son Bobby didn't like to fish or hunt. He once threw both his children over the side of a boat in order to force them to learn how to swim. Fisher nonetheless tried to hold on to the image that he was this devoted family man on the outside, you know?
Yeah. But on the inside, he was just, you know, when you got into the family dynamic, he was an awful father and husband, it appeared. But to everyone else, it looked like Bobby Sr., the Robert, was just this great – his father called him Bobby. So it was this great human being when, in fact, he was – he had some secrets.
He was sort of a dick.
Yeah, sort of a dick. Well, his mother-in-law, Jenny Cooper, told investigators that Fisher didn't socialize often with family because of fear of getting too close to people and losing them. Fisher's own mother told investigators that she had been a yes-sir wife who didn't stand up to her husband. Now, she added that she saw similar dynamics early in her son's marriage to Mary and had talked to her daughter-in-law about her concerns. And one close friend of Robert Fisher stated that his family resembled Fisher's childhood family.
See, now, this is actually something that you and I literally just had a conversation about off mic, not podcast related. But Fisher grew up in a home where his mother was a yes, sir kind of wife. And his father was a domineering sort of control freak. And so when you grow up and that's what you see, that's what you learn, that's how you become as an adult.
A product of your environment.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you think that those things are okay. And see, in some situations, and I know the exact conversation that we were talking about, because there's like five or six or 25 things that we talk about a day. But you're referring to when I said, you know, every person you run into will be a good example. They'll be a good example of how not to be or a great example of how to be.
Right.
So it's all a matter of how you depict that. And it seems like this divorce that Robert experienced early on sort of affected him later on to where he sort of like leaned more towards the way his father was versus the
way he was raised by his father. He lived with his father.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but he was 15. So he had a good understanding of how his mother was. But
right.
Obviously, he thought that that's how a mom is supposed to be or a wife is supposed to be because that's how she was. So when he got married, he assumed that that's how he was. I'm not making an excuse for the douchebag. I'm just trying to explain to you why he may have thought this. Kind of like you were saying.
Well, Fisher had been an active member of the Scottsdale Baptist Church men's ministry, but unlike Mary, he had begun to withdraw from the church's activities a few months prior to the murders. In 1998, the Fishers went to their church's senior pastor for marital counseling. Fisher told co-workers about a one-night affair with a prostitute that he met at a massage parlor. He fretted that his wife would find out that it was the cause of a urinary tract infection that left him ill for several days, but Fisher told a hunting mate that he was renewing his commitment to his faith and his marriage because he, quote, could not live without his family, possibly hinting that he would consider suicide over divorce.
Too bad that wasn't the way he went.
According to psychologists, an intense fear of loss is not unusual for an individual traumatized by divorce while as an adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
In the weeks before her death, Mary Fisher told several friends that she was going to divorce her husband. According to a neighbor of the Fisher family, the couple had a loud argument on April 9th at 10:30 p.m. approximately, 10 hours before the house blew up in the explosion. At 10:43 p.m., Fisher was spotted on an ATM camera where he withdrew $280. Mary's Toyota 4Runner was in the background.
Yeah, you can clearly see that it's her 4Runner, which, of course, was missing.
And we have this photo footage. We'll post it on our social media.
Well, back to the explosion. So before firefighters arrive, neighbors used a garden hose to try to keep the flames under control. Now, Rural Metro Fire Department firefighters were on the scene within minutes of the call and kept the 20-foot-high blaze from spreading to the neighboring homes. Now, a series of smaller secondary explosions, believed to be either rifle ammunition, maybe paint cans going up, something in the garage that was flammable, now, this forced firefighters to keep their distance, so they weren't trying to get into the home or get close. Obviously, if you got things blowing up, that's not what you want to do once there's already been one massive explosion. So there was a gas line from the back of the house's furnace that had been pulled out, obviously intentionally done. Now, the accumulating gas was later ignited by a candle that Fisher had allegedly lit, waiting for the gas to accumulate and descend to the flame hours after being lit. So basically what he's done is he's lit a candle and he's got the gas line pulled out. Now, it's not going to be something that's going to ignite immediately because the gas is going to have to accumulate in the house to where you get the right mixture, whatever. When the gas in one room meets the candle in the other room, you get an explosion. Now, this was also expedited by an accelerant that was poured throughout the house. So these poured some type of gasoline or some flammable substance on the house to try to not have it happen quickly, but to ensure that there was going to be a fire in case the candle were to blow out. At least there's something burning in the house. So he planned this out pretty good to make sure that this was the definitive result was the explosion. Now, this delayed fuse, of course, obviously would give him just a little bit of a time, an approximate 10-hour head start in his successful attempt to evade law enforcement. So you understand how this works. So he lights the candle. He's got the gas line pulled out. He's waiting for it to accumulate. And basically the accelerant was just sort of an insurance policy.
And this is after he had slit the throats of his children and wife and shot his wife in the head.
Thanks for reminding me of that, Lauren.
Investigators theorized that Fisher murdered his family because he felt threatened by Mary's intention to divorce him and did not want Brittany and Bobby to go through what he went through as a child.
Oh.
And on that note, let's take a quick break. And we are back. So on April 14th, Robert William Fisher was named as an official and to date only suspect of the case, and the Arizona Department of Public Safety officers were instructed in a statewide bulletin to arrest him. On April 20th, the last physical evidence of Fisher's whereabouts surfaced when police found Mary's Toyota 4Runner and their dog, Blue, in the Tonto National Forest near the towns of Young and Payson, Arizona, 100 miles north of Scottsdale. It was strange that the dog was found with the abandoned vehicle. Many people who knew Robert and his family claimed that he loved that dog Blue more than his family.
It was obvious.
Why would he abandon the dog?
Well, like I said, it's obvious that he loved the dog more than his family because he murdered his family and burnt the house down, but somehow took the dog. And also keep in mind, Lauren, that an Oakland Raiders hat that was identical to the one that Fisher was wearing at the ATM footage that we're going to post was inside the vehicle. Now, here's a little fun fact. There was also a pile of human poop, which was found just outside the passenger door of the Toyota 4Runner. So in my opinion, I feel like the police were actually really super close to him, or whoever found him was really close. I think he got out with the dog. Maybe he stopped to take a poop. Had to go. Everybody's got to go. Whether you're a murderer or not, you still have to go. So I think
everybody poops.
Everybody poops. And I think that honestly, he got out of the car with the dog, and maybe the dog was going to the bathroom or whatever, and he literally was doing that. And then he either heard people that found the vehicle or something that spooked him, and he took off. And the dog hung out by the car. And because it's almost like he left some identifying features there that maybe he wouldn't have. But it seems to me like maybe he took off running. So maybe they were a lot closer than they thought to him. That's why he didn't abandon the dog. But it's a survival instinct. So he was running to try to get away from whoever was finding so he wasn't caught.
Right.
What do you feel about that?
That could be. I don't know how fresh the human poop was. I couldn't find that information. But I mean, that could very well be. They could have almost walked up on him and he heard them first and took off. And
well, you've heard certain stories of, you know, if police had just gotten there 2 minutes sooner,
yeah,
or he was actually right there, or they, you know, they crossed paths, or, you know, the killer was right there in the crowd as the news reporters were filming and, you know, they see him later. You know, if you look at Golden State Killer, he was actually at one of the meetings that they had, and there's footage of him at one of the meetings, the town meetings, discussing the killer. So little things like that. And that's just what kind of brought my attention. I'm probably wrong, and he probably did hike out on foot, but it was just something I thought, like, because I don't think he would have left the dog. I don't think he would have saved the dog and then left the dog. I think something forced him to leave the dog, because I don't think that was part of the plan. That's my own personal opinion.
I wouldn't have left my dog for any reason.
Exactly. But I think if you were about to go to prison for murdering your entire family, you might. So the authorities come in and they search the area immediately around where the vehicle was discovered. Now, they searched one out of dozens of nearby caves. So why only search one? I mean, some of these caves form a complex underground network extending for miles beneath the surface, which probably is why they could only search one, because several professional cavers have suggested that Fisher used them as a hiding place before either escaping, killing himself, or dying from low oxygen levels. So it's one of those things where these guys that go there all the time, they're going to tell you, hey, these things are very complex. So it's possible that maybe they went in the search and was like, wait a minute, we can't get too far into here. We're done. We can't lose, you know, law enforcement trying to look for this guy in his caves. Now, professional cavers have visited these caves many times in the years since the murders, but they found no sign of Fisher at all. No sign of him has ever emerged. No body, no clothes, no anything. The Toyota was discovered less than a mile from the Fort Apache Indian Reservation. Now, police followed a set of footprints that led onto the reservation, but uncovered no sign of Fisher and never searched inside the reservation. Why is that?
I don't know. Why would they not search the reservation?
I think it's because I think it's probably because they can't be on the reservation land.
They have no authority on the reservation, but that wouldn't stop them from asking the reservation police to help them say, hey, we have a fugitive that might be hiding on your reservation.
Yeah, but then again, they maybe said, no, we don't want that. Sorry, you can't come. Kind of like a lot of the, you know, the Brandon Lawson case where there was a lot of properties they couldn't check.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible in that situation, in Indian reservations, they're kind of that sovereign nation kind of thing. You can't mess with their stuff. And I understand that. Well, aside from periodic unconfirmed sightings of Fisher, the abandoned vehicle remains the only and last piece of evidence uncovered in this case.
And that was uncovered in 2001. So we're talking about 21 years ago. So today, Robert Fisher, once a portrait of a church-going family man, remains the sole suspect in the murders and held a place on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for over 20 years. His picture sat beside the likes of terrorist Osama bin Laden. He was removed from the list in November of 2021 when the FBI determined he no longer fit established criteria for continued inclusion on the list.
Thought that was odd.
One of the criteria for placement on the 10 most wanted list is the need for publicity to help locate and capture a subject. But the extensive publicity Fisher's case received during its nearly 20 years on the list has not resulted in his successful location and or capture. The case no longer fulfills that requirement.
Okay.
The FBI added, is there continued danger of fugitive present in the community if not apprehended? There is no evidence that Fisher has engaged in any additional illegal activities since his original alleged crime.
Under that a name.
Despite a long and not so intensive manhunt, what remains of one of the most notorious family murders in Arizona history is the enduring mystery surrounding what actually happened on that April night. The past 20 years have given rise to speculation among some about whether Robert Fisher is even still alive. One of the most outspoken family members, surprisingly, was Mary's father and Fisher's father-in-law, Bill Cooper, who was completely on Fisher's side in the beginning. There's a video of Mr. Cooper in tears, begging Robert to come home and telling him he loved him. That's not so much the feeling of Mr. Cooper these days.
Ah, get it.
There's no doubt in my mind that he's still out there, says Bill Cooper, Mary's father. He told the Phoenix New Times. When you know it's a cold case, that makes it even harder when you think about what he is doing out there. Is he remarried? Is he still living double lives? We just don't know.
Is there some other woman who is enduring the same suffering and pain as Mary did?
And could be in danger the way Mary was?
Or maybe already was.
It could be.
You know, there's a lot of cold cases out there. I'm just putting that out there. You know, so I guess that brings us to another question. Did Robert Fisher commit suicide? Well, each year, there are about 30 to 50 cases of spouse murdering their family, known as familicide, to law enforcement. In over half the cases, there is suicide or attempted suicide following the murder, says Neil Websdale, a professor at the NAU Department of Criminal Justice and actual author of several books on domestic homicide. But most of the suicides occur at the scene or very close to the scene, Websdale said. It would be very unlikely that someone would take off and kill themselves in a remote location, which I would agree to. But I guess in the this is a family murder, but the Brian Laundrie case with Gabby Petito, remember, he murdered her, came back to Florida, took off, and then he committed suicide out in a park.
Yeah.
So not always the case where they just commit suicide there, if in fact suicide is the end game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the days and weeks following the discovery of Mary's SUV, there was suspicion that Fisher might have walked deep into the wilderness to commit suicide, which would sort of reflect the Brian Laundrie case, or actually Brian Laundrie would have reflected that case, obviously, because that happened 21 years ago. I just bring that up because that's a recent case that is similar as far as somebody who is supposedly like he wasn't really a survivalist. He was not a survivalist. He was kind of just an outdoors guy.
Outdoors guy, yeah.
If he was a survivalist, he would have passed the SEAL training and he would have been a Navy SEAL. But he wasn't. He was just an outdoorsman.
Yeah.
So, but it's kind of the same thing in that particular case. I'm only mirroring them because, you know, a lot of times when you look into these older cases, I try to reflect on cases that are recent and in the news. That's why this case has kind of got some Brian Laundrie aspect along with Chris Watts, that douchebag who did the same exact thing. Obviously, he took his family out. He didn't burn his house down, but he did kill his entire family.
Okay, but if you're going to compare those two, then you kind of have to go on the other end of the spectrum and look at John List. So John List, he killed his entire family, his wife, his mother, and his three children in Westfield, New Jersey on November 9th, 1971. And then he just took off. And they finally caught him after 18 years. And when they caught him, he was living a new life under a new name. I believe he had a new family. There was no suicide.
He just walked away and acted like nothing ever happened. And
yes.
I'm just going to start all over.
Exactly.
Well, that was 18 years later. We're hoping that 21 years later, we can get the same result here.
Right. Okay. So back to what we were talking about. I was thinking early on they would find some bones up there where they found his truck, says Lori Greenbeck, a close friend of Mary's and her former boss at H&L Medical Specialists in Scottsdale. Over the years, Fisher's disappearance and lack of any credible sightings have fueled speculations that he is dead, his remains having possibly been carried off by wild animals after a suicide. Robert's sister Jean told Unsolved Mysteries, "Where would he be? How could he have gotten to where he would be? He didn't take any money.
That we know of.
He would be in so much physical pain from his back. I don't know if he did this. I don't know how he could be alive knowing how much my brother loved his family." But his other sister, Myrna, had this to say. "If Robert wanted to kill himself, he would have done it when he killed Mary, Brittany, and Bobby. That's my belief. So I do believe that Robert is alive." And back to the clothes issue. He obviously removed all of his clothes from the home before the explosion. If he took all his clothes with him, why would he do that if he was planning to kill himself? And then that brings me to another question, because His clothes were not found in the car.
Exactly. Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and discuss what if Fisher is still alive. So, we're back. So, like I said, Lauren, could Fisher still be alive?
Well, according to officials, both local law enforcement and the FBI still receive almost daily calls and tips on reported sightings of Robert Fisher. Fox's hit show America's Most Wanted has featured segments on the case on 10 separate occasions, which has generated thousands of leads and tips.
What a great show that is.
As time goes on, a fugitive's ability to stay on the run gets better, says Greg Howell, a producer for America's Most Wanted. The ones that are gone a long time are the ones who manage to get out of the country.
Well, most recently, he's been featured on John Walsh's new show, The Hunt with John Walsh. Now, dozens of Robert Fisher lookalikes have been reported, and Scottsdale police have even traveled as far as Canada in 2003 to fingerprint one of Robert Fisher's doppelganger. This guy even had the same surgical scar on his lower back. Now, get this for a minute. Can I just humor me for a minute? Because sure. This is what I read on this. So he gets basically identified in Canada as Robert Fisher. So they believe this is the guy. So the Canadian authorities actually find a friend of Robert Fisher's.
It wasn't a friend. It was a neighbor.
It was a neighbor, friend, and kind of the same.
Yeah.
That Robert Fisher would recognize and someone would recognize Robert Fisher. And they bring him into the police station with him. And I guess there was the guy said that he knew, hey, that's him. That's Robert Fisher. He was even missing a tooth. And the same exact tooth was missing on this guy. I mean, he had the same build, the same height, the same look, the same missing tooth, the same like wonky little stare that he had. He had the same scar. I mean, everything to this guy fit to an absolute T, except the fingerprints didn't match. So they fingerprinted this guy and they didn't match. But think about that. So they bring this neighbor in there to see how he reacts. And the neighbor even says, hey, that's him.
And I actually saw – there's actually a documentary. You can watch it on Prime Video. I think it's called Where is Robert Fisher, where they interview this neighbor.
Really? I missed that. I want to watch that.
And the neighbor said that they brought him out and he looked at him in the face and his eyes got wide and there was instant recognition. This Robert Fisher doppelganger looked at his old neighbor – and there was like instant recognition in his eyes. And then he tried to turn his head, put his face down, you know, tried to like hide as best he could. But
yeah, so there was body language there.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that they did prove with this guy is you, because obviously changing your fingerprints is not an easy thing to do.
No.
You can sand them down, you can alter them, but changing them is almost impossible to
right.
do. But what they did is they took this guy's fingerprints and backtracked them several years back. You know, all the things, you know, from when, you know, the different times that this guy had passports and things like that. So his fingerprints go run back. It's not a matter of, you know, oh, he altered his fingerprints, which a lot of people thought. They theorized that it's possible that this gentleman decided to go ahead and change all his information and because he wanted to take on this new identity as this guy in Canada. But in fact, it was not Robert Fisher. It was just one of those things where they say everyone has a doppelganger. And this just so happened to be that guy that was so identifiable as Robert Fisher, but in fact wasn't.
Well, as we mentioned, Fisher was last captured in a surveillance photo on the night of the murders, withdrawing $280 from the ATM machine at the Wells Fargo on Scottsdale and McDowell Road in Scottsdale.
Well, one thing that I've also got to bring up here, and is the $280, because I've seen a lot of questions about why $208? What's the significance? Some cases, that's all they'll allow you to get out of an ATM. So you're only allowed at such a daily limit. Now, obviously, this goes back 20 years ago, 21 years ago, that he took this money out. So they did have lesser limits. There's more limits now and things like that. But that also brings me to the topic of why the hell would someone who's going to go out and commit suicide go to the ATM and take out money?
Maybe he didn't know at the time whether he was going to commit suicide or not.
but he took all of his clothes, so that would identify him as not wanting to commit suicide. Go to the ATM and get money out. I'm not going to commit suicide. I needed $280. Why didn't he take out more money? Well, because maybe that's all he could get out. It was nighttime, and he didn't want to go to the bank during the day. He had a murder to commit. He couldn't just be out running around. I really hate this guy.
All right. Well, he was wearing – in the ATM footage, he was wearing an Oakland Raiders baseball cap and driving Mary's silver 2000 Toyota 4Runner. Police later found the baseball cap left inside the vehicle, though the other items missing from the home were never found. As I said earlier, where is his clothes?
Yeah.
Now, this fueled speculation that Fisher likely fled the scene from where the vehicle was found. He may have even had an accomplice helping him, but that's never been proven. Adam Trahan, Fisher's former coworker, said, "I think if he's alive, one of the possibilities is in Sierra Madre, Mexico. It is known for its lawlessness. He could hide in that area very easily."
Well, one question I have too, Lauren, and maybe you would agree. This seems to me, obviously, it's obviously something he's thought about, was premeditated, I mean, with doing the accelerant on the floor,
right,
lighting the candle. So he's kind of mapped this out in his mind. He's timed it out, what he's got to do. He's gotten the clothes out of the house. He's gone to the ATM. This is as premeditated as you can possibly get. So what's to lead someone to believe that this was something he just came up with in a week's time or in a couple days' time? Like, I'm doing this. I've only got a couple days to get all this done. What if this is something he was planning for months?
What if it was?
And he's had sort of a cache somewhere where he was storing stuff and stowing stuff.
Well, actually, you bring that up, and there was speculation because he did go out hunting and fishing. He went on these hunting and fishing trips almost, I want to say, like every weekend or every other weekend. And there was speculation at one point that he may have been going out and stashing things or building some sort of place for him to hide out for a while. But that none of that has ever been found. Nothing of that nature has ever been found. So we don't know. Maybe he was just hunting or fishing, but...
Well, Lauren, there is a theory that Fisher may have, like you said, used his survival skills to continue living in the wilderness near Payson, which is where his wife's car was discovered, the Toyota 4Runner. Now, although police and the survival experts are skeptical, obviously this is due to the difficulty of finding food and shelter in that environment, as well as the fact that no evidence has ever emerged of someone living in the woods in that area. It has been suggested that Fisher may have crossed the southern United States border. Now, there was a hostile encounter that occurred in Guatemala in 2009 between tourists and a man said to resemble Fisher. So, you know, this kind of leads investigators to think more along the lines of it's possible that he did leave the U.S. I mean, Fisher's disappearance did take place before the September 11 attacks, which the border security at that time would have been more lax and obviously not as stringent as they are today. So it's possible that he could have crossed over the border a lot easier. I mean, police have considered this to be a reasonable possibility.
Well, Robert Caldwell, FBI special agent, said either he is still in the United States or has snuck into Mexico or Canada. I personally believe by now he's hooked up with somebody the way he is, the way he was such a control freak with Mary. I'm sure he's found companionship. If he did find it, it's probably with a woman who he's extremely controlling of.
That's a good possibility. I mean, obviously, he's not going to give up that trait.
So police have speculated that Fisher may have started a new family and have cited the fear that he might eventually decide to leave and annihilate that family like he did his original family as one of the chief reasons for continuing to search for him. Just like I said about John List, he killed his whole family and then went on, had a whole new family. Some people have, however, conceded that they may never learn what happened to Fisher. Maybe this is the best we have, knowing he did it and never finding him again. FBI agent Bob Caldwell's sense of his personality and habits is that he is arrogant, he's cocky, he's a know-it-all, and he's a loner. Fisher's been known to chew tobacco and favors the Copenhagen brand. His look has been described as average, but he sometimes walks in an odd, erect manner with his chest out due to back problems stemming from the injury he suffered as a firefighter. And again, he's an avid outdoorsman, hunter, fisherman.
Not a survivalist, which leads me to believe that he didn't stay in the woods for too long. He may have had enough stashed to where he could have gotten to one of those caves, survived, and possibly maybe got out after the heat was off. So maybe he was planning ahead and packed a cave somewhere that he knew about that would be hard to find if you didn't know where it was. Mm-hmm. And stash enough stuff in there to, you know, to get you by for a couple weeks until you could maybe the news cycle is different. Somebody else, you know, is on the news big time and you can kind of go under the radar a little less noticeable. So we'll keep this in mind. Fisher is considered armed and extremely dangerous and has ties to, of course, Florida and New Mexico. Now, if you have any information about Robert Fisher, please call the Scottsdale Police at 480-312-5000. That number again for the Scottsdale Police, 480-312-5000. So, Lauren, is there anything else you want to add to this? I mean, this is a serious case of a man who, like I said in the very beginning, is supposed to protect his children from monsters. And turns out he was the monster that he was supposed to protect them from.
I know. Family annihilations are really hard to cover, to think about, I don't know.
You know, and honestly, Lauren, in looking at this,
it's hard.
Regardless of the age of the children, they're still kids. They're still children. You know what I mean? When you do, their throats were slit. Their throats were slit.
I know.
This is up close and personal. I mean, you know that they saw it coming.
Yeah.
You know they saw this happen.
Well,
I mean, I feel like they
were asleep. That's just what I'm going to think.
One of them may have been asleep. I can't imagine both. But I fear that maybe their eyes opened and they saw it transpire. The same thing in the Chris Watts case. I absolutely hate this. And I would love for this piece of shit to get arrested and thrown in prison where he can live the rest of his life getting brutally beaten by other people, other inmates.
Well, it's like we always say, if you see something, say something.
Yeah, please call Scottsdale Police. Call 911.
Call 911.
Call Crime Stoppers. Call any and everybody you possibly can. We're going to post some stuff on social media.
Yeah, I'm going to plaster his face all over our social media this week. So,
but because he's not ever been found, no identifiers at all, no bones, no remains. So we can only assume that it's possible that he lives down the road to someone listening to this episode right now or someone who has seen this documentary Lauren talked about. I mean, he's living next door to possibly another family.
Right.
And that's a scary thought in my mind because obviously he didn't care about his own. He damn sure isn't going to care about yours. So, Lauren, like I said, anything else you want to add? I got to get that out because this case just makes my stomach turn.
No, that's going to be it for tonight. And I just want to remind everyone that we are going to be taking a break. We'll be back at you on August 1st.
And remember, if you're missing us and you just need to listen to us, you can go to patreon.com/PalmaHawk Media, PalmaHawk Media. Check us out on Patreon. That'll give you some content. You can listen to us if you miss our angelic voices. Listen. So be sure to check out our website for all our social media. There's actually a link right there for the Patreon merch store and all that good stuff. So, you know, you can always hit us up there or just patiently wait. We'll be back at you August 1st. And we really, really want to thank everyone for listening
to Paradise After Dark.
Dark, 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 dark.